Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for a lease. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly. They can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Out.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you're having is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't, lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity weight, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
Speaking of that video that the president just posted about 4 minutes.
People who live in towns and cities in Uganda and many other African countries have some access to grid electricity to light their homes and power their businesses. But many rural people aren't connected at all. But simply waiting for the grid to arrive isn't good enough for entrepreneurs like Moses Akera. He recognizes there's a good business to be made harnessing the power of the sun.
I really prefer solar to be used in the community like this because it remains the property of the clients. You don't pay bills and you don't buy fuel like somebody using generator.
So solar energy is the best option for many rural Ugandans. But being new to the industry, many solar retailers like Moses were struggling to make their businesses a success.
We don't have capacity to advertise ourselves, our products. We don't have capacity to have quality technical training.
So the Rural Energy Foundation, a not-for-profit organization, introduced the Solar Now program in 2007. Its aim, to spread the benefits of electricity throughout rural Africa by providing training and support to existing solar retailers like Moses. And they encourage other retailers and entrepreneurs to start selling solar equipment from scratch.
Most of these retailers need to be supported in terms of training so that they can be able to run their businesses better. They also need support in terms of market awareness because so many people out here in the field do not know about solar, so we need to come and enlighten them.
As well as training, the Rural Energy Foundation loans retailers portable demonstration kits, which they use to drum up business in local markets.
What we're trying to do is these people are off-grid and they do not have access to electricity. So we're trying to show them how solar can improve their lives. For instance, we try to show them how they can make money from solar. For instance, here with us we have a shaver, so they can use this to have barbershops. We also show them how they can use it to use light at their homes. See, when you have this light in your house, the children can study at night. They can use it in their shops to work longer hours, and they can use it at home.
If retailers want to use the Solar Now brand, they have to commit to providing high-quality installations and good after-sales service. The Rural Energy Foundation helps them achieve this by training solar technicians.
We're trying to get the entrepreneurs to sign service contracts, so when they sell the product, it also comes with after-sales service. Let's say they have to check to make a phone call to the customer after a certain period to check if the system is working, and then till after some time through the service contract, they also have to go and actually do the inspection of the system.
The Rural Energy Foundation has trained over 200 retailers in 9 African countries. So far, they've sold 57,000 solar home systems and 36,000 solar lanterns. They've helped at least 400,000 people, saved nearly 5 million litres of kerosene and 12,000 tonnes of CO2 each year. Basil Okelo is impressed and has decided to buy the equipment from Moses to set up his own solar barbershop and phone charging business. He's taking advantage of a credit scheme which helps entrepreneurs buy equipment from Solar Now retailers to get their businesses going.
Solar Now is giving me a loan. I'm going to make a down payment of 25% now. Later, in 3 months' time, I'll make another 25%, making a total of 50%. Then the remaining I'll complete within a period of a year.
With his system now installed, Basil is optimistic about the future.
Because this is a new investment I'm going into. I have never been into this business before. But as I see, I have the expectation that I'll make money.
Moses is growing his solar retail business too. He already had a shop in town. With support from the Rural Energy Foundation, he's now set up a small village branch to cater specifically for his rural customers.
Rural Energy Foundation is very important to us. If they help us training technicians, we shall be in position to expand all over.
We hope that others will also adopt the private sector development approach. We don't want to be unique. We want to spread the word that this is a really efficient approach to get the technology diffused deeply into the rural markets.
the Rural Energy Foundation plans to expand into other African countries and broaden its range of sustainable technologies. Solar panels are now becoming a common sight here on homes, and shops buy them as well to run radios and offer phone charging, increasing their income and enabling people to communicate. And to everyone's delight, the local bar has installed a fridge powered by the sun. The owner is pleased with his investment.
Yeah, we're happy. Of course, it's cold. The beer tastes better. And so I get more customers.
Because I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there and looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do. And,
but we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be. Super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you're driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off with things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses. They could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. And there were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
Just to ask for justice, I mean, and be very specific about what you're talking about in the process. Get away from the slogans. Go in, if I'm talking to anybody who's a politician, go in with a list of things, always. Just don't go in with abstractions and say, well, we black people would like to have our freedom. We'd like to have better neighborhoods. We'd like to have better schools. These are titles, and that's an excellent start. But you have to be specific. In my school, I want this to be taught, so that when I walk out of that school with a piece of paper in my hand saying that I have graduated, I want to know exactly what I'm going to be doing with at least this first part of my existence. What are the opportunities available to me where I can walk in a door and present my diploma, my degree, and say, this is what I have learned, and I understand that in this place where I am now, I can use what I have learned in this place where they have sent me as of this morning, because I was in that university day before yesterday. I took a day off to rest. Now I'm coming in ready to go to work in this place, because this is the place where I can use what they taught me in that university down the street. And I'm in this place where I knew that this is the place that I was going to come to so I can make money to take care of all the things that I am required to take care of in a constructive manner. I can gain that money here by giving my services to this facility, because I knew about this facility before I ever left that university, because that's the kind of university it is. It doesn't teach you just a whole bunch of stuff and tell you to go out into the world and change it, and you don't have an idea of how to even get started anywhere. Not a name, not a phone number, not an address, not an idea of where you can use USE, what you have been taught.
I'll be as quick as I can, as quick as it takes to kill somebody, I guess. You want me to be that quick. But, you know, as Ms. Fletcher pointed out, and it doesn't take much to look on the local news every night and see how many black kids, black boys, black men are being killed with these stand-your-ground defenses that these people raise, and they get off. So I take issue with that. I'm the only person here of color, okay? I am a mother, too, and I have a son. And I care as much for my son as y'all care for y'all's. But my son doesn't walk the same path as yours does. So this debate deserves more time. I'm in Pine Bluff. We have killings regularly down there. Mr. Hunter knows. He's our prosecutor. Now, I don't know where the heck, I know where you are from, Gary. And I don't know really where Mr. Ballinger is from. But I can tell you that for a long time since I've been back here in Arkansas, I have feared for my son's life. Now, he's 27. He's out of Arkansas. And I thank God he is. When you're bringing up crap like this, it offends me. And then to limit the debate too, this is crazy. You don't have to worry about your children, Will. I worry about my son. And I worry about other little black boys and girls. And people coming into my neighborhood, into my city, saying they got open carry rights, walking down in front of my doggone office in front of the courthouse. That's a bully. Do I have a right to stand my ground with some crazy-ass person walking around with a doggone gun? I don't know what the hell he intends to do, but I know I am scared. I feel threatened, just like some of y'all walking around here up in the legislature with these damn guns. That, what's his name, Garner, came in here, walking around here with a damn gun in his, under his coat. You can see the damn print.
Senator, you need to stop.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't. What the hell are you going to do, shoot me?
Senator.
Senator, shit. What the hell? I'm telling you, this deserves more attention. You want to come up here with all these little NRA bills and bills that Alec have and all that stuff. I'm talking about my son's life. And I'm talking about the lives of other black kids. the hell you want to do. Go ahead, but you can't silence me. You got your damn silence gun out the damn chamber today, but you are not going to silence me.
Senator Flowers, if anybody hasn't tried to silence you, it's me.
To win. We need to get this over with. He said we were going to be down here all night. You got all these people up here. NAACP is here too. Let them speak. I'm going to limit some damn debate.
Senator.
What?
You're out of order.
And so what?
So you're out of order.
Okay, so what?
You're out of order.
And so what are you going to do about it? I am upset.
You need to be upset somewhere else.
No, I don't. I got a right. I'm an elected officer just like you.
All right. Today we're with, well, we're not with, we're covering The Promised Land Ain't in Egypt, Part 3. The Promised Land Ain't in Egypt, Part 3. And I want to throw out some statistics here. And so, now, last Friday, we went into a historic black township, Mount Bayou, Mississippi. Let me throw out some towns, some further information. Out of the 19,500 municipalities in the United States, now there are more communities than municipalities, but I'm just giving you the 19,500 figure. 5% of them, approximately 975 towns, Um, 86% of the population of the United States lives within the confines of 975 towns. And the population is over 330 million. So once again, out of 19,500 towns, less than 1,000 of them, that's where 86% of the population of the United States lives. 92% of the black population of the United States lives within those 975 towns. Once again, there's a total of 19,500 municipalities. That doesn't include unincorporated communities, which would probably double or triple the number that we see here. Number two statistic, 70% of the towns of the United States have a population of 5,000 people or less. Now, in relationship to the 19,500 total towns or municipality, that's 14,820 towns. That's where I call the real United States of America. When you hit towns that have a population, in my opinion, when you hit towns that have a population of 5,000 people or less, and, well, look, the barometer says it all. 76% of the towns in the United States have a population of 5,000 people less. That's 14,820 towns. There are only 10 towns that have a population of a million or more people. Now, let's just go through that. San Jose, L.A., and San Diego, three of the 10 towns that have a population of a million or more people, there's only 10 of them, are in California. Then we have, in Texas, we have Dallas, San Antonio, and Houston. So between two states, you've got a significant portion, percentage of the United States living in just those 10 towns. I mean, excuse me, six towns. Then you got Chicago's in there. That's seven. But you can look up the stats, but I find that very – but anyway, so just 10 towns out of the 19,500 towns have a population of a million or more people. But they're highly regulated. You can't put a tiny house in many of those places, particularly in the top 10. But once you get into the 76% of the townships that have a population of 5,000 people or less, that's 14,000. That's a lot of townspeople. There's only 365 days in a year. If you're looking for freedom and what I call the real United States of America, you've got over 14,000 towns in this country to check out. And once again, they're only 365 days in a year. It'll take you some time, you know, just if you visited one a day. Just one a day. If you start a day and did one a day, you're not even going to put a dent in the 14,820 towns, they have a population of 5,000 or less people. That's the sweet spot. That's the beginning of the sweet spot. Let me put it that way. Once you cut that number in half, 2,500, things get better. Once you cut that number in half, towns that have a population of 1,000 people or less, it gets sweeter. Once you cut it down to towns that have 400 or less people, you're doing real well. But 76%, it's 76%. Those towns were formed by people that say, you know what, I don't like the way this bigger town is operating. I have less freedom. So you know what, let's get together and start our own towns. And there are over 14,000 of them. I think some people during this inflationary times, you really need to revisit the American dream. At one time, New York City, Chicago, places like that, Boston, D.C., L.A., Miami, that's where you can get the where you could attain the American dream at sustainable levels, economically speaking. Now, it seems like in a lot of those larger cities, and you have to have more income coming in. So many of you might need to revisit the American dream. While you're trying to make it in Los Angeles or Chicago or someplace like that, Seattle, you know what? 30 minutes to an hour away, you might have to check out a town. And matter of fact, I'm going to put that out there right now. If you're homeless, if you're struggling, living in a tent, living out of your car, and you don't like it, if you're living in one of these residential motels, look within, matter of fact, if you got internet access, which you probably do, on your phone, on your tablet, on your desktop, maybe in the library, start looking for towns within a 60-mile radius of where you are right now, 60 miles or less, for communities that have a population of 5,000 people or less. Then after you find those towns, make your list, you know, and then do your research as much as you can online, and then start looking at housing prices, land prices. All right. Now, I'm going to say extend. Now, this is what I've done. I look at, let's see, let me put it on my calculator. Okay. My radius is, let me look at it, because I got two or three different radiuses I look at. Okay, wait a minute. Okay. Oh, I don't want that. Oh, wait a minute. Okay. All right. All right. I have, let's see. All right, 71, let's see. All right, I've got like a, one barometer that I use to look for affordable places is I have a 90-mile radius. A 90-mile radius. I have a larger one than that because I'll go to, how far does my radius extend? I got an in-state radius of 90 miles and let me see. Okay. All right. And I've got a 1,600 mile radius. In state, okay, because I'm in Florida, within the state I have a 90 mile radius within the state. All right, which is, let's say 90 minutes. Because within 90 miles of where I'm at, prices really drop. Now, I got a larger radius outside the state, which is 1,600 miles. I look for stuff 1,600 miles away. All right, but you got to crawl before you can walk. So I would suggest to people look for stuff. I'm gonna put it at 90 miles. Give yourself a 90 mile radius. That's an hour and a half, and you'll be surprised at what you can. Now you can stair step this. Start looking for things. I don't recommend 30 minutes, but all right. No, I'm going to stick to it. 90 miles. Give yourself a 90 miles, and then you can shrink that down to maybe 60 minutes, 60 miles. Now, there's a town, and here's what I'm talking about. And I'm going to do a feature on them, and I reached out to the Chamber of Commerce, but they haven't got back to me yet. But I think I'm going to have to do a field trip there, but a community that has mentioned to me, that's been mentioned to me twice, and I'm taking that as a sign, go visit this place and model what they do. And you can follow me online, Yoder. Yoder, Kansas, that's Y-O-D-E-R, Yoder, Kansas. Yoder, Kansas versus New York City. Now, you can substitute that with St. Louis, Chicago, L.A., Seattle, what have you, but today we're doing Yoder, Kansas versus NYC. And I'm putting, and you know what? This goes along with what we covered last Friday, which was Mount Bayou. Because, see, once you take a look at what they're doing at Yoder, all you need to do is incorporate in what they're doing with what they've been doing for 100 years in Mount Bayou, Mississippi. Now, I'm on Wikipedia, so Yoder, Y-O-D-E-R, and this is where the ball is at, people. Okay. For many different reasons. Yoder has a population of 165 people. That's it. 165 people. Yoder is a it's an Amish, predominantly Amish Mennonite community. Now let's go to the history here. The community derives its name from Amish founder Valentine Yoder. The first post office in Yoder was established in November 1889. The community was home to the former Naval Air Station Hutchinson, later renamed Hutchinson Air Force Station and currently named as Sunflower Aerodrome Gilderport. Now, once again, they've got a population of 165 people. If they have a website, the city has a website, or rather the town has a website. And then, now, once again, now, Yoder's got under 200 people. And this is what I call the real United States of America. Now, let's see. We go to Healer Merchants, and this goes down to the last little note I have on the program notes, production villages and consumption communities. Yoder is what I would call a production village. Most of these 165 people are entrepreneurs. Here are the businesses in Yoder. You got Blue Shed Antiques and Guns, Bullseye Grill, Carriage Crossing and Restaurant and Bakery, Eggly Energy, Great Plains Family Medicine, Heritage Tours, Hitchin Post RV Park, Journey Mennonite Church, Kansas Station, Yoder Meats, King Solar, they got two solar villages, two solar businesses in town. The Little House in Yoder, Auto Contracting, People Bank and Trust, Yoder Auto Center, Yoder Discount Grocery, got a grocery store there, Yoder Farm and Ranch, Yoder Fence, Yoder Furniture, Yoder Hardware and Lumber, and these are simple bread and butter businesses too. All right, Yoder Meats / Kansas Station. Oh, man, hold it. Let me go back. All right. Yoder Fence, Yoder Furniture, Yoder Hardware and Lumber, Yoder Smokers, Yoder Thrift Shop. They also have a quilt business there, and they got Yoder Heritage there. Well, that's something for the whole community. So, and this is in a town of 165 people, men, women, children, babies, the whole kit and caboodle. Black folk, I recommend not so much to move to Yoder, but move to a small town where you can set up shop as a business person. And if you can get a small group of you together, because I just read through a short little list here. Move into a town that's already established, that's got a small population, or start from scratch. Take your choice. Now, here's another thing I like about Yoder. Oh, and I also started this Yoder versus Kansas City. Yoder, Kansas versus New York City. You're not going to hear about an Eric Gardner, a Trayvon Martin, a George Floyd, a Mike Brown. That's not happening in places like Yoder, Kansas. I can name easily over 10,000 other towns right here in the United States. You're not going to have that kind of problem. In my program notes I have here, production villages versus consumption communities. Yoder, Kansas, with its 165 citizens, is a production society, is a production village. Most families that are living there have a family-based business where they're making products. They make quilts. They do solar panels installations. They do baked goods. There's a family restaurant there. There's a smoke shop there. Most of these businesses, which are, and Yoda's thriving. You don't even need to go to college. Everybody knows everybody in Yoder. That's not the case in Minneapolis, Minnesota, where George Floyd met his demise. Or Ferguson, Missouri, where Mike Brown met his demise. Or New York City, where Eric Gardner met his demise. Another comparison with Yoder, Kansas versus New York City. In Yoder, there's no social services office. Now, there are a lot of Yoders now. I'm just picking this one out because this one has been recommended to me twice. Two different people that don't even know each other said, you got to check out Yoder. And if both of these people have been to Yoder. But there are other communities like Yoder, and where are you going to find them? You're going to find them in the 14,820 towns where a lot of people, you know, that once again, that 70%, 76%, 86% of the population lives on only 5% of the landmass, but 76% of the towns in the United States have a population of 5,000 people or less. Yoder, 165. Now, you're not going to go to Yoder and get a come up on the social services office. It's not because they don't have it there. They don't need it. We're talking about a community that basically is, virtually, when it comes to mortgages, debt-free. I mean, from institutional lenders. I'm sure they probably got some private stuff going on there. But, you know, from the Wells Fargo, Bank of America, FHA, VA, and all that. Now, they government entitlement programs, particularly when it comes to housing, Yoder probably doesn't even exist at all. But I would recommend, no matter what age you are, young or old, in between, if you don't get together with some people and start your own Yoder, because you can start from scratch or you can go into a town that's already established with the infrastructure and all that and go in there and say, you know what, let's set up shop and let's start producing. And you've, matter of fact, let me count this up. All right, Yoder's got 165 people. So So let's go through this again. I'm going to count this time. Yoda Thrish, or let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 20, 22 businesses in Yoder. 165 people. What did I name? 20-some-odd businesses. All family-based. Oh, wait a minute. Stand corrected. There is one business here that's probably not a family-based business. People's Bank and Trust. Matter of fact, let me look them up. People's all right, here we go. People's Bank and Trust, Yoder. Let's see. Making sure I have the right location. Okay, People's. I don't think. Oh, wait a minute. People's Bank and Trust. Okay. People's Bank and Trust Company, Yoder Branch. Okay. People's Bank and Trust, which is a bank in Kansas, they happen to have a branch in Yoder. Okay. So outside of People's Bank and Trust, which has a branch in Yoder, essentially every business in Yoder is a family-based business. Okay. And they don't have a Wikipedia, at least I don't see one. And, of course, within each family, they have their own private banking. Now, let me see if I can look up some more information on Yoder. What's the name of it? Oh, I think I found it. Statistia. Okay, let me... Yoder, Kansas. Okay, let's see what we have here. It's not coming up here. Wait a minute. Let me put all results. Okay, it's not showing up on here. All right, on Statistia. Oh, man. All right, let me try one more. Well, maybe they don't deal with stats below a certain number when it comes to a city. Okay. Let me see what they have on here. Okay, statistics, outlooks, infographics. Let's see what they have in the way of statistics. Popular statistics, topics. Um, okay, proper statistics. All right, well, let's try it another way. All right, Yoder. Results 3, but I don't see the results. Okay, I'm going to play with it. Well, let me see. Toggle options. Okay. Let me see. Let me try it again. Yoder. Try it that way. All right, city data. All right, we might come. Okay, Yoder, Kansas are founded in citydata.com. Okay, Yoder, Kansas, population of 210. They had 194 people. 111 were males. That's 57.5%. Females, 83 of them, 42.5%. And most of these people are blood related some kind of way. The median age in Yoder is 53 years of age. The median age in Kansas is 37. So they're a little bit older than the average person in Kansas. Their estimated household income in Kansas is $62,000, and Yoder is $52,000. But in Yoder, they really don't need cash like somebody that lives in the larger city in Kansas, because they produce. Let's see. Per capita income, a little bit over $27,000. Okay, that's just very... Nearest city with a population of 50,000-plus people, Wichita, Kansas, I've been there, with a population of 344,000 people. The nearest city with a population of 1 million or more people is Dallas, Texas. And Dallas is 360 miles away from Yoder, and Wichita, Kansas is 33 miles away from Wichita. So now that would fall within my 90-mile radius. 90 miles or less within the state. So if you're struggling in Wichita, you know, now more than likely you're not going to, they'll welcome you in, you know, I can't speak for people from Yoder because I haven't been there. Look for a town like Yoder or start your own town. Get together with a handful of people. Yoder started with one person. And what you don't know, there's others who do know. And there's a lot of little satellite towns connected to it. Pretty Prairie, Kansas, 3.7 miles away. Willowbrook, Kansas, 3.6 miles away. Partridge, Kansas, 3.4. All of these towns have their little own economies. So anyway, I'm going to close it out unless you guys got some questions or comments. But now we're going to take a look at other towns like Yoder. Because once again, you're not hearing about anything going down negatively. Not to say they don't have crimes in these places. But my suggestion to black men in the United States, find you a Yoder, Kansas. Move. Bolgie, Alabama. Try that place out. Utah, Alabama. Try it out. Hopkins Park, Illinois. Try it out. Pembroke, Illinois. And we're talking about 45 minutes to an hour away from Chicago, depending on the traffic and the route you take. And organize yourself a production village. One of the reasons why I play Factory City so much on here so much, because Factory City in China is a production village. It's a town. They produce things, coffee pots, electric irons, waffle irons, and the list goes on, where families live together, stay together, play together. Well, Yoder, Kansas, and other communities like Yoder, Kansas, you know, you're not going to find a metro in Yoder. There's no bus line in Yoder. That's okay. Practically every place that you need to get to in Yoder, you can walk or take a bike. It's not for everybody. But if you're, man, why struggle in New York, Chicago, Seattle? Why struggle in all those places where you can go, once again, anywhere from, my radius is 90, my basic radius within state, give yourself a 90-minute radius, a 90-mile radius. All right, we got quite a bit of time left here, so what I'm going to do is if you guys want to chop it up about Yoder, production villages versus consumption villages, you know the number, 619-768-2945. Other than that, I'm going to play Factory City for, if anything, for new people that haven't heard it before and for my motivation. Because that's where I'm at. Getting together with people, let's put together a production village.
What's it like to live where you work? For most of us, that's unthinkable. But imagine living and working at one of the biggest factories in the world. A workplace the size of Monaco. For these 17,000 employees, it's reality. They come from all over China, seeking a brighter future at this factory called Yupa. Workers craft coffee makers, irons, and electric grills in staggering quantities every single day. But Yupa is more than a steady paycheck. It's home. People get married here. They send their kids to school here, but the work never stops. Yupa's managers are on a mission to produce new products for every corner of the globe that could forever change the way we think of made in China. Step behind the closed doors of modern China into a factory the size of a city. Welcome to the place that calls itself Factory of the World. By the time you finish watching this program, Yupa's 17,000 Chinese workers will produce nearly 20,000 electrical appliances. Every day they churn out 60,000 irons. Every month, UPA makes 36,000 coffee makers. That's two new machines for every Starbucks on the planet. And every year, these laborers produce a staggering 18 million electric grills. Stacked side by side, they span the Atlantic from New York to London. Chances are you own something built right here. Factories like these don't exist in North America or Europe. But they're not uncommon in China, where labor is cheap. UPA runs on human sweat alone. No need for robots. To ensure non-stop production, workers need a steady stream of parts. Someone has to make sure those parts get to the right place in time. This is Ming Long Pa. He started work at UPA in 1994.
I'm in charge of production control. Production control is the brain of the factory. Its main function is to coordinate each department.
If any of UPA's factories run out of parts, Mr. He's job is on the line.
The production line cannot wait. We have to guarantee that our production is smooth. Running out of materials would affect our efficiency, affect our productivity, and affect our revenue. So I have to fix this in the shortest time possible.
Today, a problem at the iron factory needs smoothing out. Workers on the iron line are low on a crucial part. To keep up production, they need 2,000 units, and they need them now.
Just now I found out the main problems here at the iron department. One major problem is the case for model 603. They need 2,000 right now.
Traditional plants use outside suppliers for their components, not UPA. To slash costs and stay competitive, UPA builds its own parts on site. So Mr. He's supplier is only a bike ride away.
有多少数量？三千个是吧？三千个，赶快送过来。好，这些没有了，已经没有了。是是。But
even the supplier is dangerously low on stock.
大概因为现在生产线已经停掉了，然后我大概要赶快把它送过去哈。好的，七点钟准时安排送料。对对对。Mr.
He has found barely enough parts to last the day.
好，谢谢谢谢。好。好。
When he gets another urgent call. Now the grill factory is low on a crucial component. Grills are the company's most profitable products. UPA started producing one line of grills in 1994. Now, 60 assembly lines churn out 800 different models. Workers make one grill every 12 seconds. That's 50,000 grills per day, or 1.5 million per month. Enough grills for every person in Dallas. Grills bring in $350 million a year. But UPA wants more. Little wonder Liu Jinye acts like a general leading his troops to war. By next year, managers expect workers to crank out $500 million worth of grills. UPA's profits have to rise to outmuscle the competition. Mr. Ye supervises 850 workers on 30 lines.
We have to coordinate all these workers and pull all their thoughts into one. It takes teamwork to accomplish our goals, to get the results we want.
Mr. Ye is obsessed with quality control. His aim? Boost output without compromising quality. In a factory this big, with a production run so massive, even the hyper-efficient Mr. Ye hits a roadblock.
This holder piece holds the grill plate. What we're seeing now is the assembly of this piece. The problem is the size. It's the wrong size.
They've run out of part number 2627. It attaches the core heating element to the frame. Without this simple component, assembly lines will shut down. Unless Mr. Ha finds a fresh supply. And soon.
If we don't get them the parts, 6 production lines will have to stop.
When every part is on hand, grills assemble like a simple puzzle. Wires are linked to the heating element, and the element is fixed to the plate.
When it's not locked down properly, it will fall off. If it falls off, it will burn the hands of our customers and consumers. This job is very important.
Then it's time to connect the power cord.
The brown wire is live and the green wire is neutral. The one with the writing on it matches the brown wire. Connect them and that makes the wire live.
Each grill is inspected for flaws in construction or appearance. Finally, every grill is tested to make sure everything is in working order. On a typical day, Mr. Ye's team must make 700 of Yupa's 50,000 grills. Missing parts cause delays, cost Yupa a fortune, and force workers into overtime to meet their quota. Finding the missing parts falls to Mr. Ha, and the pressure is on. Mr. He finally arrives, and he has good news. He's found 2,000 parts to keep the lines moving, and 50,000 more are on the way. Mr. He's day has ended on a high note. He heads home to a company-subsidized apartment only minutes away. His wife, Hong Zhang-yu, also works for the plant. Together, they lead a life of relative luxury. Family life in China is a communal affair. His parents and his in-laws live here, thanks to Yupa. It's one more reason workers are fiercely loyal to their company.
Our products all have the Made in China tag. I hope our products can bring to consumers a sense of joy, a sense of it's worth it. This is my biggest wish.
Fulfilling that wish will come at a cost.
When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Yupa's next generation of workers must leave their families behind and devote their lives to the company. It's a place tourists never see. The new face of modern China. Competitive, hungry for profits, and ready to take on the world. Located near the city of Xiaomeng, the Yupa complex sprawls for 1.8 square kilometers, almost the size of Monaco.
We have about over 20 buildings here. You know, the largest building, you know, equal like 4 football fields. You can have 60 to 70 assembly line. Each assembly line can have 25 to 35 workers in the line.
25 years ago, there were no factories here, only farms. In the 1980s, the Chinese government decided capitalism wasn't so bad after all. The communist regime established so-called special economic zones, designated places for free markets and foreign investments. Yupa, a Taiwanese company, moved here in 1988.
In a few short years, it became the largest manufacturer of irons, electric grills, and espresso makers in the world. Yuba is a city unto itself, with restaurants and convenience stores, soccer fields and basketball courts, and living quarters for everyone from students to families. Success made it big, and size keeps it successful. Mass production runs push down costs. Almost all parts are made on-site, keeping supply costs low and parts within easy reach.
Because we are in this location pretty much isolated, we don't have satellite suppliers around us to build, you know, parts for us. So we had to do it in-house, and we had to do it in a large scale.
Yupa's main advantage is a cheap and endless labor force, ready to work for a fraction of a Western wage. 16-year-old Mao Fen Guo left her family and came here in 2008. But Guo isn't just looking for work. She's here to escape poverty and make her mother proud. In China, many parents prefer sons to daughters.
My mother has only two daughters. She's always upset about that. And in order to not let her down, I must work harder and harder.
Guo is a worker in training. With about 1,000 other students, she attends Yupa's on-site trade school. To get here, she had to pass entry exams and pay Yupa tuition. Now she's enrolled in 3 years of study and hands-on training at the factory. If she does well, Guo hopes for a job at Yupa.
At the very beginning, I thought it was very hard. But now that I've gone through all this, it's easier. There's a lot to learn, but I'm still full of confidence.
Today, she and her classmates are learning everything they ever wanted to know and more about irons. To get a job, Guo must learn the ins and outs of every product line.
We're changing constantly. Last time, we were making grills. Then we changed to coffee makers, and now electric irons.
Workers on 27 production lines pump out an iron every 15 seconds, and as many as 60,000 irons a day. Production includes at least 10 separate brands for dozens of companies. With over 30 steps to assembly, iron making is intricate work, and there's no room for error. Assembly starts with a water spray unit, made up of springs, rubber, and washers. With training and practice, it snaps into the spout in seconds.
If it's not closed tight, it will leak or blow. Then it won't work properly.
Now the sprayer and spout are joined to the handle. The two parts of the water reservoir are placed in a heating machine. That melts the space between them and makes the reservoir watertight.
Welding is an important part of production. However, it will be easy as long as we follow our operational guidelines.
Next, the thermostat is attached to the base.
You need to make sure you're using the correct format before you insert the base. Using a wrong base can lead to fire. Wiring is also important. Where there is a wiring mistake, there's hidden trouble.
A plastic buffer is placed between the heating element and the handle to keep the handle and the user's hand from getting too hot. After that, the plug is welded to the back of the iron.
We're connecting the wire for the power supply. I can do about 4 to 5 pieces every minute and 300 pieces an hour.
Once the spray and steam buttons are attached, it's testing time. First, the steam and squirting functions. Second, the iron's electrical system. Faulty units are either repaired or removed.
finally, irons that pass inspection are packed up and shipped away. The team won't cut corners or settle for second best. Today, Guo and her classmates will put classroom theory into practice and work the iron mine. For a teenager from a small town, living and working in a giant factory can be overwhelming.
My life is not as hard as it was before. I'm getting used to this place now.
Work on the iron line goes better than expected. For Guo, juggling work and school isn't that difficult. The hard part is leaving family and living far from home.
I guess it's learning how to be independent. When I first arrived here, I didn't know anyone else, and we all have to live together. It was really tough in the beginning.
Like China, Guo is adapting to a new world of high technology and tough international competition. And like China itself, she's determined to succeed.
I don't see myself working on the production line forever, doing the same job. Maybe I'm a bit arrogant or too confident about myself, but I want a better future.
For some people, a better future keeps them married to their job. Workers at Yupa are married to the company. Based in southeast China, Yupa is one of the biggest factories on the planet. Today and every day, its 17,000 workers are getting the world ready for breakfast. In the next 24 hours, it will produce 1,200 conventional coffee makers. Over the next 30 days, these assembly lines will deliver 210,000 cappuccino espresso machines. In the space of 1 year, nearly 2.5 million coffee makers will pour out of Yupa and into the kitchens of the world. At the center of all this is Young Li.
We already have 200 or 300 styles, and we develop and add over 40 new styles every year.
Lee's mandate is crucial and broad. Tackle any problem that could slow down non-stop production.
We have to make every effort to find these problems and to solve them. We have to make sure that every process is working perfectly. Manufacturing shouldn't be delayed because of these problems.
Today, he's got a brand new kind of problem. One of Yupa's big clients has designed a new coffee maker. It's up to Lee to build a working prototype to entice the client into going ahead with mass production. Hundreds of Yupa jobs and millions of dollars in potential business are now in Lee's hands.
Making prototypes is a large portion of my job and is vitally important to the development of the company.
Lee starts by assembling the heating system for the water and steam. Then he carefully places it into the main body. Just when Lee's ready to assemble it all, there are parts missing. The supplier is just a walk away, a long walk, but Lee doesn't mind the distance. Someone special is waiting for him at the supply depot. The person helping him today is his girlfriend. These perks make Yupa more than a place of work. With a workforce of 17,000, many of them married with kids, this factory city turns office space into personal space.
Sometimes we work together. For example, if we need the help from the technician to solve production problems, then we meet each other afterwards.
Lee Yang Lee works in the parts supply department. She first came to Yuba in 2004.
We fell in love at first sight. I always think it must be God who makes her work here and wait for me. Even now, I still think the same.
Yuba management encourages these intimate connections. They believe couples that work together are more loyal to the company.
By working in the same company, we can go to work together and take care of each other. We can see each other more often. What's more, we can be with each other when we have a problem.
With the missing parts in hand, Lee is ready for wiring. Making it all fit into the chamber isn't easy.
I will have to organize all the electrical wires properly to make sure the coffee maker operates safely.
But the real test will come after shipping. If the client approves of Lee's model, Yuba could get a massive order. If it doesn't, hundreds of jobs are on the line.
If I make the prototype in a sloppy way, our customers will lose confidence in the quality of our products. It will be a great loss to our company.
Weeks later, Lee's model is approved for mass production. And right away, he sets out to create a brand new production line. It takes a week to prepare the assembly line and train the workers to make the new coffee machine.
Making a coffee maker is not an easy job at all. It requires professional knowledge and a profound understanding of coffee culture.
When the prep is done, Factory City springs into action and works with astonishing speed. Lee's prototype took half a day to make. Now line workers churn out 700 machines a day. Lee's shift is done, and when work ends at Factory City, romance begins.
When we're done work, we normally go shopping together or take a walk. It gives us a sense of happiness.
The couple plan to get married at a mass wedding, paid for and organized by the company. All at once, dozens of Yuba workers will tie the knot, while thousands of co-workers look on.
If we take part in the group wedding, with the best wishes of all of our co-workers here, we know we will be getting married in the factory of the world, one dream, and that would be unforgettable.
A mass wedding is the couple's way of showing their love for each other and their passion for Yuba. Chef Xing Ming Li has a passion of his own, feeding the 17,000 workers that power the factory of the world. At Factory City, the day has barely begun. But Chef Xing Ming Li already faces his first daily deadline. Li runs one of five independent restaurants at Yuba. Competition between them is intense. Profits are razor thin. And Lee needs thousands of customers every day just to survive. In his eyes, he's not just serving meals, he's fueling the workers that power the factory of the world.
If they don't eat well, or eat enough, they won't have enough energy. Then they won't perform well at Yuba.
It all starts with fresh ingredients. Beef, pork, bok choy, onions, carrots, and winter melon.
We have all fresh seasonal vegetables here. Whatever you can find from the food market, you can find here.
Everything is washed, sliced, and diced. Yuba churns out millions of kitchen appliances a year.
But there are no food processors in Lee's kitchen. Nothing is automated. Everything is done by hand. By 9 a.m., Lee's staff is already racing against the clock.
We'll have to finish everything before 11 o'clock because Yupa staff restaurants all open at 11:30. We have to be there in advance.
In 2 hours, 3,000 workers will stop by for lunch. Lee expects just as many for dinner. This means his staff of 50 must serve 6,000 meals by sunset. That's 125 kilograms of oil, 50 kilograms of beef, and 300 kilograms of pork. That's more than 1 million tons of food every year. His chefs turn stock ingredients into hundreds of delicious dishes.
We can make different cuisines. Our chefs are all the best of their hometown.
They cook up dishes from Fujian, Sichuan, and Henan regions, and they'll soon add halal fare for Muslim clients.
I believe everything that we cook should taste like what your mom cooks for you at home.
Lee's obsession with food comes from growing up hungry.
My family was very poor. Although my dad was working very hard to earn money, he still didn't have much food to eat.
Now food is never in short supply, and all of Lee's clients return to work with their bellies full. Lee's passion for food has made him a perfectionist. He hunts the market for produce that's perfectly ripe and reasonably priced. In his kitchens, Lee controls the cooks, and no dish goes out without his approval.
Too bland. Some salt and chicken stock will make it taste better.
The special today is spicy Sichuan pork.
Actually, anyone can cook. The key is our chefs make their own special seasonings that you can't get from the market.
Lee insists the pork must be extremely fresh. He expects perfect timing from every cook.
Timing is what the chefs are really good at, but they may not be willing to share that information.
But now it's almost 10 a.m., and Lee's kitchen is about to hit the boiling point. With the clock ticking, the team of chefs are stir-frying and stewing to feed an army.
It might be a bit of an exaggeration to say that it's a battlefield, but it's true that we're really busy. We have to finish everything within 1 hour. Then we will deliver them to our restaurants. We don't have time to do other things.
By 11 a.m., they pull it off. Dozens of different dishes for 3,000 people and right on time. Drivers rush the dishes to the restaurant nearby. Competition between the five independent restaurants at Yupa keeps quality and choice high and prices low. Workers pay about 50 cents per meal, thanks to a company subsidy. To turn a profit, thousands of customers must pass through Lee's door each day. But it's not profits that keep Lee up at night. More than anything, he wants people to enjoy his food.
I've experienced a lot of sleepless nights. I often blame myself for the mistakes that occurred in the daytime. I should have done better.
So far, his customers look happy. After lunch, while workers crank out appliances, Lee will be planning dinner, determined to satisfy his next 3,000 customers.
I hope that Yupa and everyone else will trust me and become my friends. I'll be content if they all come to dine in my restaurant.
If feeding workers at the factory of the world is tough, try being the guy who must make everyone get along. In this factory city, 17,000 people live and work inside 1.8 square kilometers. Rush hour is a human traffic jam. Just getting to work on time is a job well done. Inside these walls, office politics and conflicts play out on a massive scale. The man managing all this human friction could have Yupa's toughest job of all. Now in his second year on the job, Ya Xin Fu is the manager of Yupa's service department. His job, address anything that affects the day-to-day life of Yupa's 17,000 workers.
I have to find a balance between the costs of the company and the needs of the employees. Too little and the employees will be dissatisfied. Too much and the company won't be happy, so it's a big challenge.
Keeping Yupa's army of laborers in line is no small task. At this regular weekly meeting, Fu is boosting company morale.
Leading them is like raising children. We have to raise them with love.
Yupa's workers come from every corner of China. Most are in their 20s and 30s. They work on average 40 hours a week and make between 90 and 320 US dollars a month. While wages are even higher in big cities like Shanghai, many Yupa workers make double what they did back home if they had any work there at all. As with any mass organization, thousands of employees create endless demands. It's Mr. Fu's job to address all of them. He does everything he can to keep everyone motivated and committed to staying at the factory of the world. Fu visits staff living quarters as part of his regular rounds.
We're now going to the workers' dormitory. I routinely go there to check if anything can be improved. If there is, I will talk to the superintendent.
Fu is part landlord and part tenant's rights advocate. Today, he's ensuring Yupa rooms are ready for a group of new workers. Average rent is only $6 per month, but the type of accommodation depends on a worker's rank and the amount of money they are willing to part with. Fu is paying a visit to Mao Fen Guo, who has a noise complaint. Fu believes that to build quality products, Yupa's workers must be well rested and well fed.
The challenge is that there are 17,000 employees and they come from all over China. Everyone has different tastes. I have to take care of everybody.
Yupa's restaurants are extremely competitive, and some have been known to skimp on meat portions to keep costs low. Yupa has strict rules about when and where vendors can sell their food. Fu keeps them in line.
Now we are going to check on the other restaurants. We have designated areas for them. If they break the rules, I will kick them out.
These vendors aren't trespassing. They work for the factory's restaurants. but they are breaking the rules by selling food too close to rival restaurants. Everyone must have a permit. A veteran on these streets, Phil recognizes this woman. He busted her once before. Today, Fu lets everyone off with a warning. Next time, he may ban them from selling food at Yupa.
I talk to them, but they will break the rules again, so I have to check on them every day.
China's web of cultures complicates Fu's job.
Everyone comes from different families and different provinces, so their customs of eating and living are totally different, so I have to adapt to them.
But one thing unites all of Yupa's workers, the world's most popular sport. On the field, tension and stress vanish.
Because employees are undergoing a lot of pressure at work, we have to give them an outlet and let them exercise. But most important is the team building.
Don't care for soccer? Yupa offers other ways for workers to get their exercise.
For entertainment, we have ball game competitions like basketball, table tennis, and other games. These sorts of competitions.
It's all part of Fu's mission at one of the world's biggest factories. A place with no boundaries between work and life. For Fu, it's a never-ending battle to keep the peace and to keep the company together.
It really is a miracle. A company this big, with all the employees together, holding hands and moving forward. This is not easy.
And while there may be harmony inside Yupa's walls, outside, competition is cutthroat. In a global market, innovation is key. Yupa's employees must endure tough changes to survive. In the global marketplace, there's no room for second best. To survive, companies need a competitive edge. Like most China-based companies, Yupa has relied on low labor costs, making products designed by others. But it wants to move up the production food chain. Yupa's leaders want to design products of their own. They have little choice. To thrive and survive, Yupa must develop a new generation of products. The factory's very existence depends on it. Thousands of jobs hang in the balance.
No work means not being able to live. This is a fundamental requirement. It's how humans survive. You have to earn money to make a living, and to earn money, you have to work.
Jirong Pan knows how high the stakes are. He is Yupa's Vice President of Product Innovation.
I think innovation is the competitive edge of our company. Because our company is in the field of home appliances and the whole home appliance industry is a lifestyle industry.
Mr. Pan sent his staff overseas to study the lifestyle products of the future. They returned with a simple message. The future is green.
We studied the consumers of North America and Europe and their thoughts on this new energy of the future. So we know that their love of the earth is actually very strong.
Pan and his designers make a bold decision. The first appliance in Yupa's new product line will be powered by the sun. It's a solar CD player.
We want to bring this clean solar energy concept into people's homes.
Going solar may sound easy, but solar panels are expensive, and they're meant to work outside, not in the dim corners of people's homes. A 3D image of Yupa's appliance of the future starts to emerge. Now the team must turn a digital design into reality.
This factory is a very important part of our development process. It helps turn a product concept into a finished prototype.
Using the design specs, a computerized milling machine cuts a foam cast. And the cast is converted into a hard plastic prototype. If things go according to plan, the model will be used to produce millions of identical copies.
It allows us to test the product to see if this fulfills our requirements while bringing value to the customers.
Now engineers perfect the solar power system. The system must collect and store solar energy. Every aspect of design must maximize energy efficiency.
We've spent a lot of time studying this. What kind of technology, what kind of material, what kind of parts can help us improve our energy efficiency?
Finally, Yupa's product of the future is revealed. The solar CD player is simple and elegant. The player will charge indoors when left near a window. And the system is uniquely versatile. It will work with any energy-efficient appliance Yupa designs. But one question remains. Will the world embrace Chinese solar products?
We want to bring what people originally thought of as an industrial thing and truly integrate it into their daily lives to enable consumers to truly experience solar energy. This is a very magical energy concept.
If these innovative products succeed, Yupa could achieve its dream, a dream it shares with China, to be the factory of the world.
I want consumers and everyone to have faith in our products and faith in the workers. I hope everyone can enjoy the products we produce. This will make us proud.
With Factory City in full swing and new products in the works, more and more goods will carry the Made in China label. But for China and Factory City, growth comes at a cost. Every day, the 17,000 people at Yupa endure the stress and uncertainty of a cutthroat world economy. To fight off fierce competitors and build a better life, these men and women work and live together as one at the factory of the world.